They had 11 ground stations starting over here. And what you see is those circles are the range that station could see it when the satellite went over. And you'll see you got squiggly lines like this one here at Ascension. That was because there was a mountain in the way. Now, believe it or not, most of these huge antennas they had were built in valleys, not on mountaintops. You would think, well, logically, you want to put them on the mountaintop, you can see farther. But the fact is, by building them in the valleys, they were using terrain masking to filter out any extraneous radio and television and stuff like that.
Can I just say, to interrupt for a second, I've been to Honeysuckle Creek many times, and a high technology area that got the pictures from the moon, your phones don't work there. It says no service. It's in a valley, and there's no radio reception. So that's why they put it there.
Okay, but what they did was, if you start in the upper left-hand corner here, that's the station at Bermuda. They had a big station at Bermuda. The second one, the round circle, is actually a ship. They had three ships that were capable of tracking. They had one that was always in the recovery area, but they had three that had big antennas on them, and that was from the ship Vanguard. The next circle over, the third one, is in the Canary Islands. This one down here is Ascension Island. Down in the South Atlantic. Incidentally, Ascension Island is so far out, the nearest land was St. Helena, where they exiled Napoleon. Then we go over, but look, there's a great big gap all the way over here to Carnarvon, up in northwest Australia. And then here we have, actually it was a combination of burying three. You had Honeysuckle Creek, you had Tidbinbilla, an antenna that was just coming up, and also the big antenna at Parks was just coming online at the time. And so you continue on, and that next circle up there, that's a station at Guam. And finally, we have one outside of, on the Big Island at Hawaii. And going back over, you have the next one is Goldstone, Corpus Christi, Texas, Merritt Island. But you'll notice that every one of those, heck, look right here. Look at Honeysuckle Creek. They were in a valley. And you can just see how erratic. Once the satellite crossed that boundary, no communications. And so this is why NASA came up with a variety of different stations. Okay, first of all, like at Carnarvon, they had 11 of these that had a 9-meter dish. And it would rotate as it come over. Now, if it went right straight over, they could track that satellite for 6 minutes. So any activity they wanted, they could contact it for 6 minutes. Now, the farther away it was from the zenith, the less time they had, because the circle gets smaller the closer you get to the edge. Okay, this is one of the 26-meter dishes that they had for the Deep Space Network, basically Honeysuckle, Madrid, and Goldstone. And this one is actually, you can go down and see that if you get up to Tidbinbilla, because it's still there. They took down the Honeysuckle Creek station in 1981, but they saved this antenna because it actually has a certain amount of historical value. And they actually used it to track space missions until 2010. Then, of course, we had the big ones at Parks and Tidbinbilla. That's a 70-meter antenna. Can you imagine something almost the size of a football pitch and moving it? And that was those are the big ones. That's what helped augment the smaller 26-meter dish antennas. Okay. Then they had four ships. Three of them had 9-meter antennas on them. And they would go in pre-position. They'd send them out a couple weeks ahead of time to wherever they wanted them. And then they could serve just as the basic function as ground stations. They moved around a lot, but they didn't get very far, about 16.5 knots. It's pretty slow, but it did the job. And finally, they came up with 8 Apollo-ranged instrumentation aircraft, and these are the ones I worked with. We had a couple of advantages over the ground stations. The first is our planes flew at 30 to 35,000 feet. And so because of that, we didn't worry about ground scatter at 35,000 feet. Besides, we're out over the ocean anyway. But the beauty of it was, we could see it much. We could see the satellite much farther when it came over, because actually we could track it for 10 minutes, which is translated to about 2,200 miles. We could track it for 10 minutes. And the other advantage was If we needed to change something due to an emergency, we could move the planes at 500 miles an hour. In fact, it had right in the it looks kind of funny because it's got that big, large nose on it. And we'll get into that in a minute, but it had a 2 meter, it had a 2 meter diameter dish in it that was extremely mobile. But for some of you, you might recognize that it has a certain resemblance to a certain cartoon character. Think Peanuts. It was Snoopy. And so they were actually known as Droop Snoots or Snoopies. Sometimes when the ships were out at sea, it was going to be a week or more before they could get their data tapes back to Houston. So what we would do is we would fly a plane over, and they would replay their data tapes that they had captured from the spacecraft. The airplane would record it and keep right on going, and then they could use those tapes at Houston. But let's take a look at the Apollo Range instrumentation aircraft themselves. Like I say, they were known as either Droop Snoots or Snoopies. I know, go ahead, laugh. That's okay, we've done that. But ARIA was the acronym they went by, and it was pronounced ARIA. Okay, meanwhile, you could pronounce it ARIA, but it's no opera, believe me. Okay, this is a typical four-engine jet, Boeing 707. Hey, it's the early days, Boeing 707. This particular one, we had two airplanes that could carry this pod on the side of it, and it was an optical tracking system. It could track a Volkswagen at about 150 kilometers. I mean, it was that accurate. And it was used particularly in some cases during launches, and it was also used to capture the reentry of Apollo 8 when it came back from the moon. Now, I said it had a 2 meter dish antenna in the nose, and you'll notice this really is kind of an interesting. We had something that the big stations couldn't use or couldn't do. We had, notice in each quadrant, you've got a little antenna like this. There's four of them. And then, of course, we have the main high-speed data antenna in the middle. Well, when the spacecraft came over the horizon, the first thing they would hear was on VHF. And those four VHF antennas were remarkably simple. They would take and balance the signal. And when they balanced the signal on all four, the high-speed antenna was pointed right toward the airplane. Now, once they got it pointed toward the airplane, they started gyroscopes going, so that no matter which way the plane turned or what happened, it would continue to follow the spacecraft across the sky. And what's more, you'll notice, looks like ears you can see the best one on the right, it was yoke-mounted. So you had your yoke and you had the antenna in the middle. So not only could it go up and down, it could turn any number of different directions. And if you got near the limits of the antenna when it couldn't turn anymore, solves the problem. You turn the airplane. So it was really kind of neat. Inside, take a look at the inside of the airplane. We had here, you've got down here, here's your antenna in the nose. And we had various equipment. We had UHF. We had one operator. And these are all enlisted people in the Air Force. We had one operator that was dealing with the data that was coming down from the spacecraft in telemetry. We had another position for the guy who controlled the antenna initially and then monitored it. And the mission control was actually an officer. Well, we had to give him a job. He was an officer who was in charge of the whole back-end crew. Next, we had high-frequency communications because early on, when you're out over the ocean, and we didn't really have access to satellites at the time, they would literally run a 100-meter piece of wire out the back end of the aircraft, and the signal would come in through the nose and go through the various filtering, and the voice would go out over this 100-meter antenna. And we had three stations, particularly in the Pacific, for example. We had three stations. We had two run by the Overseas Telecommunications Commission here in Australia, one at Doonside and the other, one station was at Doonside and the other was at Bringelly. And they would take the stronger of the two signals and they would fire it off. We also had a station at Guam and a station at Hawaii. And each one of them are listening to this high-frequency transmission, which was the voices on the astronauts, and they would send them all to Cape Kennedy. We had a man there that would take the strongest signal from the three different sources and send that on to eventually getting to Houston. Then it would go back in reverse the same way when Houston talked to the astronauts. And then timing. All of our tapes had to be timed. Now, we had I said there was a lot of telemetry data. Most people think of a signal wire, you got a picture and you got an audio, but there was a tremendous amount of digital data that was being, I mean, it was a waterfall. And we had two recorders, each one could record 14 channels of data simultaneously. So there was a huge amount of data coming down, and of course these would go onto the tapes. Next, we have our timing position.
Sorry to interrupt. Can I just say, in those days, everything was recorded on tapes. We didn't have solid-state memory to record things on. So we had big reels of tapes, and they were big tapes, and you could store lots of data on the tapes. Problem is, they were physical. You had to take them somewhere, and you had to play them back to get the data.
Right. Thank you. Finally, we come to timing. We had a rubidium 87 atomic standard that put one track on the tape was always the timing that the event happened. And the event was always relative to the time the rocket lifted off. Because when the rocket lifted off, it started a clock. It was called the ground elapsed time clock. We called it the get clock. And everything on the mission was programmed to the minute, which sometimes is okay, but sometimes it can give you some problems. But it was programmed to the minute as to what was supposed to happen on the spacecraft and because they knew this, and this plan was developed over a period of months. The stations around the world, because they're on different time zones, the stations on the world could schedule their people to work. Now, it wasn't that they weren't always working; they had basically three crews. You had your prime crew, your second crew, and the third crew. And the prime crew was, if that station, like Goldstone, handled the moon landing. So they had their prime crew on. Okay, Honeysuckle Creek was scheduled to cover the moonwalk, which happened also. It just said it happened 4 hours early because they had programmed in their infinite wisdom. They said, hey, you're going to land on the moon and you're going to rest for 4 hours before you go for a walk. And when they got there, Neil Armstrong says, ain't going to happen. We're going to go now. And there was havoc, particularly at Honeysuckle Creek, as these guys are trying to catch up, do 4 hours of preparation work, and get them done before Neil Armstrong went to walk on the moon. And then finally, we have our recorders in the back. Like I said, we had two. They had two, and they would record at 120 inches a second for 10 minutes. Huge reels of tape. They were one-inch tape, and they would hold, like I say, 14 channels. Actually, 13 of those were data. There was always one channel for timing. Okay, so conceptually, this was how NASA planned things. Remember, we had that big long gap between Ascension Island and Carnarvon? Well, the signal to go to the moon generally was always planned to go through Carnarvon, and it always did, on the third time around, what we call Revolution 3. And so the spacecraft was in contact with Carnarvon, and you hear him say, go for TLI. That's translunar injection. Light your engine and go to the moon. And Carnarvon would tell him to light the engine. They'd light the engine, but by the time the engine stopped, they were outside of Carnarvon. And so now we've got to fill the gap between. We'll take a look at that later. But basically, they wanted to be able to, during that period of time, 15 minutes, 14 or 15 minutes, NASA had to have contact with the spacecraft. And so they're like 10 minutes before, where's the spacecraft? It's out over the Indian Ocean. No ships there. They put in airplanes. Then for 2 minutes around ignition, and particularly 2 minutes following the engine cutoff, they had to be able to talk to the astronauts because they didn't have any data to tell them how the engine worked, how things worked. And so they needed to be able to get reports by voice from after cutoff. And then we operated at two frequencies, very high frequency, which is actually they do a lot of radio with VHF. But they also had this, they developed this thing called Unified S-band, which was really, really high. For those that are radio geeks, it was 2280, the voice was 2287 megahertz, so it was way high. But it allowed them to pack a huge amount of data into a small part, into a signal stream. And then here you see the aircraft at the maximum slant range was 1,230 miles away, which that's great, but the satellite's coming over. So actually, 1,230 miles one way, That means it's also getting at 1,230 miles coming in the other way. So basically, they could travel at nautical miles. So you're probably talking pretty close to 2,500 nautical miles that that spacecraft is being tracked. Then, later on, we did get satellite access about Apollo 13, and then they could relay, again, once they started getting phasing into satellite communications, then they would go direct. We could get rid of the high-frequency long wire, which was always kind of dicey. Okay, so you can see they had a specific period of time that NASA really needed to have information. There was another time that, again, this is something that could never be covered by a ground station, mainly because they always brought the thing down in the ocean. I mean, hundreds of miles from anywhere. But sure enough, we had three airplanes out there. One would be about 300 kilometers to the north. Another would be 400 kilometers to the north. One 400 kilometers to the south, and then we had one in the middle. And the one in the middle would be designated the prime aircraft. And when they came out of blackout, the aircraft would, first of all, they'd pick up the electronic signal, the beams, just the beam, and then Houston would call up and talk to the astronauts and back and forth. Yes, blackout. When they came back from the moon, they actually had a very narrow window. They had to hit the Earth's atmosphere. And as they came through the atmosphere, the spacecraft heated up and it started to ionize the reentry shield, which was insulated, and it would start to flake off, and it created this ionization layer that they couldn't broadcast through, and so it was called blackout. The window they had to hit was a hole in the atmosphere, like 100 miles up. That they had to hit it relative. They couldn't go any less than 3 degrees, and they couldn't go any greater than 7 degrees. So they had a 4-degree window keyhole they had to hit. And the reason was, if they'd hit it less than 3 degrees, the atmosphere, even at that, as thin as it was, would act like skipping a rock off of the top of water. It would just hit there and bound off, and then they're gone forever. Maybe, hopefully, orbit around the sun. But if they came in greater than 7 degrees, if the G-forces on them, the gravity forces on them that built up, didn't kill them, then the spacecraft would probably burn up anyway. So they had some really narrow tolerances it took to get a man back from the moon. But like I say, one of the jobs of the airplanes, because they were portable and move, they would be out over the, in this case, they all brought them back over the Pacific Ocean. So, and we'll cover that a little bit later. Okay, so this is where what did we do with the planes? Well, we could put one plane at Ascension Island. This is to cover anything that NASA wanted it to cover during the launch period. It would fly out north, south, but it would fly outside of this range that Ascension Island could see. That looks like it's sitting in the middle of the ocean, and it is. Cocos Island, Keeling Island, either one, take your name, it's both. It's Australian, by the way. So we had a couple of planes at Cocos, had one at Darwin, and another one. Oh, let's put a second one out there at Cocos Island. And the reason is because this was a long span, and so one would fly one way, one would fly the other. I mean, you might find one actually supporting down here and another one supporting right here, but they're passing this signal on from aircraft to aircraft or from station to station, and it all goes back to Houston. We'd put one at Townsville. Now, Townsville could be used as a backup because once they left Carnarvon, and this is the Rev 3 here, they light it here, you follow it all the way up and you don't see it until Hawaii. Again, you got to find ways to cover it. So we would normally use the one at Darwin to cover this place, but we had one at Townsville for a couple of reasons. One, because it would serve as a backup if necessary, if something went wrong, because things go wrong with airplanes. It could back up the one at Darwin. We had a plane up at Guam. It's kind of interesting. Okay, we had a plane in Hawaii. But these are to cover contingencies. Okay, for example, the plane at Guam, actually, and this happened in Apollo 11, it was kind of interesting. You'll notice Rev 3 is down here, but Rev 4, because they always planned to go on Rev 3, but if something went wrong and they delayed the, They could delay it 90 minutes to sort out any problems. Then they go on Rev 4. But again, they'd still get the go, no go out of Carnarvon. But oh my golly, look at the space track on Rev 4. It's about 1,300 miles farther west. So they had this, you'll see here later, how they moved the, we had one at Guam that could be plugged in there. Now, the fun part was this. They went on Rev 3. So Guam didn't have anything to do. They had a plane. They were all ready to go. I mean, just ready to fire up the engines, warm up the equipment and go. Well, he didn't get a chance to go. But about 8 days later, he was coming through Hawaii on his way back to Florida, and they says, oh, we've got a job for you. We've got this box of rocks that we need to have dropped at Huntsville, Alabama. He says, whatever you do, don't let it out of your sight. And so they gave it to the mission controller, and I had lunch with him here in Phoenix, Arizona last October. And he says, for 11 hours, he sat right next to that box of rocks because nobody was going to get those lunar rocks away from him. Okay, now, yeah, what happens is, you see, during the mission, we can take this plane at Darwin and move him down into this area here where he can get a much better signal. And you can see at that range, now look at the difference. This is the range that our airplanes could track, but compare it to what's on the ground. So we had a much higher, much longer tracking time with the spacecraft. Okay, during recovery, generally the recovery was out here. No ground stations anywhere near it. So what we could do is we'd take the one at Townsville and we'd move it over to Nandi in the Fiji Islands. We'd take the one from Guam and we'd move it to Pango Pango, American Samoa. And Hawaii, we'd move into Pango Pango too, because these three aircraft were going to be the ones that supported the reentry when the mission was over. Okay. And they'd fly out into that circle and position themselves accordingly. And here's a good example of the issue with how the planes work. Here you've got the ground track. So we take that one to Darwin and move him down here so he's right in the middle of the circle. They had two other ships. They had two ships in the Pacific. One was the Mercury was at Sydney, and the Redstone was up out of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And they could move those in, but sometimes they were using them someplace else. And so quite often, and particularly in the case of Rev 4, what happens is we can move the planes 1,000 kilometers in an hour and a half. And so you can see the dotted lines would be where the coverage, and in this case you can see where that plane that was sitting at Guam would have come into play, because even if one or more of the ships wasn't there, we still had the area covered. Just a very brief finishing up. I worked at Araya Control. I was the facilities manager there. But I had two jobs. One was to make sure the equipment was all operating in the facilities. But I want to show you something. You'll believe, now you got to remember, this is 1960s technology. For Apollo 4, 5, and 6, which were strictly proving the equipment, the lunar module, the command module, the rocket itself, all we had was a worldwide map covered with acetate, and we could go and use tape to put the ground tracks. We even had little icons for the airplanes. That was our technology at the time. And then you'll notice these consoles. Now, what you don't see is this is actually taken from the back of two rooms. And we had the primary staff, the ones that the controllers that are working with the airplanes were in the front room. And in the back room, we had the support people. Now, you'll see a couple of positions there called instrumentation. Common sense is I don't speak airplane. I don't speak electronic equipment. But if we had something go wrong with one of the recorders, we had a crew that was always available to us during a mission, and we could get the recorder man on a position that he could talk directly to the airplane and help resolve the problems. Interesting thing is that notice the handsets and the dial. You know, that's what a telephone dial looks like. Okay. Another interesting thing I'll just point out as a matter of interest. We've got all of these lines of switches, and those are different combinations of people that can talk on it. But the first one was what we called Net 1. Net 1 we could never talk on because that was the one that the astronauts talked back and forth to Houston with. But Net 2 was the second switch. Okay, second switch. And all was a toggle. You could just press it down and talk to anybody in the network. I mean, in one case, we actually did have a case where we had a reason to call Carnarvon. So we just press it down and say, Carnarvon, Araya Control. We were known as Araya Control. They say, and they'd come back and say, Roger, what can we do? And we'd have our conversation. But like I say, every various combinations were connected to those other switches. Then in during Apollo 7, they totally redid our control center, and they gave us computer-driven displays. Our map board was out. They gave us computer-driven displays that were driven by the tracking computers at Houston, and we had a big light display on the right there that actually I had a chance to operate. Oh, it was lots of fun. It had 270 switches because I could take each aircraft. For each aircraft, I could go through each subsystem, whether it was a frequency or recording or whatever, and we had light, red, green, or yellow, and if it was red, you were in trouble. That means somebody, in many cases, if we had an airplane go red, that means it was out of the picture altogether. Red cannot support. But fortunately, we kept most of them green with a little bit of scrambling. So, see, now what we did was also, we took the, got rid of that wall. We actually found the wall was a problem because when the controllers needed some information, you had to walk around through a door. So what we did was we put all of the support people in front and all of the control people in the back. It was a much improved thing. That way, if you needed to talk to somebody, you turn around and give them the paper or do what you needed to. Okay, well, this is when our airplanes were back, they were called Snoopies. So when they were all back on the base, we called that the dog pound.